Maine's economic outlook for the new year. Pity the economic prognosticators. It is a tough time to predict what might happen in the new year. On a national and international front, they must consider stock market volatility, new tariffs, Brexit, and other world events. Here in Maine, the government is changing. A new legislature has already been sworn in, and a new governor takes the oath of office this evening. Meantime, Maine is seeing historic unemployment combined with a shrinking workforce and aging population. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we'll talk with the state economist and the president of the Maine Development Foundation about what may be in store for Maine's economy in 2019. What are you watching? What are you concerned about or bullish about? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is a new year and almost the beginning of a new administration. Today, we're going to talk about the economic outlook for the year ahead. Joining me, two excellent economic forecasters, Amanda Rector, the Maine State Economist, and Yellow Light Breen, President and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation. I want to thank you both for joining us today. And as always, we want to hear from you. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the state's economic outlook for 2019? You can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Welcome back to both of you. It's hard for me to believe it's been a year since we sat down and chatted, but why don't we just start with a big broad question, and I'll start with you, Amanda, from your seat. How are we doing? How does it look?
Yeah, so 2018 appears to have been a very strong year altogether, not just at the national economy, but for the state economy as well. Certainly, at least in the near term, it seems like 2019 is going to continue. Certainly, there are some elements of instability at the moment. So depending on how closely you follow things like the stock market, things may be a little bit dicey if you're too closely following that. But the underlying sort of fundamentals of the economy still seem to be pretty solid. Certainly, if you look at employment figures, we've seen record high employment levels and record low unemployment levels that we hit in 2018. And those are some very good, strong numbers. We've also seen strong income growth that's gone along with that, and reasonable GDP growth. You know, certainly the population growth has been better, still slow, but a lot of improvement around the migration, which is really, for us, the most important piece, given what our overall demographic situation looks
okay,
like.
Okay, and I want to talk about population estimates in a little more depth in just a little bit. But Yellow, I want to turn to you from your perspective. How is Maine doing? How is Maine doing compared to a year ago when we sat in this chair?
Sure. Well, from a personal perspective, like many Mainers, I'm in the middle of filling out financial aid forms for college for two students. So my outlook is mixed. And I think really, though, that's a segue to the challenge facing our state, which is how do we dramatically ramp up the education and skill levels of Maine's workforce in order to take advantage of this still growing economy? The one thing that could be a lid on our economy increasingly, it's been a lid a little bit in the recent past, it could be a lid on our economic growth in the future, is we just don't have enough workers, and we especially don't have enough skilled, highly educated workers in the state.
And the gap is positive, in the tens of thousands, correct?
Yeah, you know, we may actually see our workforce shrink as the baby boomers leave the workforce over the next 10 and 20 years. And so backfilling them, but also backfilling them with folks who are capable of, you know, working in the jobs of today in terms of healthcare, in terms of financial and business services, including including precision manufacturing versus maybe the industries of yore. So I think I'm always an optimist, but I think that optimism going forward will depend on us being really focused in investing in the future of Maine's workforce.
All right. Well, Amanda, you mentioned the stock market before. How difficult is it? Does it affect your, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head the economic term, does it, your confidence going forward with your predictions, the what's going on the stock market, the tariffs that have been kind of up in the air, Brexit, across the pond. Does this make you less confident in when you make the predictions about the Maine economy?
You know, I feel like there's always some different mix of things going on that are complicating my life in terms of forecasting the economy. It's always a matter of keeping an eye on the news, not just locally, but globally, because all of those different things that are happening around the world do affect our economy. And then from there, trying to sort of estimate how much are we going to be directly impacted by that, and are there things that might affect us differently than other places? For example, I think of oil prices. Maine actually does much better when oil prices are low because we have a lot of reliance on home heating fuel and gasoline. So when energy prices and gasoline prices are high, we don't have the money as residents and businesses to spend on other things because we're spending all of our money on heating our homes and our businesses and transporting things around. Whereas there are states that are very big producers of oil that see just the opposite problem. So when prices are low, their economies suffer. So it's trying to figure out, you know, what are the peculiarities? And certainly with the tariff situation, figuring out how much is Maine's economy going to be affected? There are some sectors that are certainly more affected than others. Broadly speaking, at least thus far, it hasn't been a big impact sort of across the board on our economy, but there have been some businesses and sectors that have had to hustle to try to figure out how to deal with the repercussions from that.
And Yellow, you've just recently released Making Maine Work, and I know that part of that you surveyed business leaders. I want to talk about it broadly in a minute, but following up on what Amanda said, how much is the tariff situation and the changing tariff situation affecting their thinking?
Well, we surveyed over 1,000 Maine business leaders, and as we did 8 years ago when we had a change in administration. And it's interesting to see the transformation in their responses from 8 years ago. And so number one concern on the minds of business people is health insurance and the cost of health care. That one was actually the same as 8 years ago. The next four, though, that made the top five were all different. And it was availability of entry-level workers, availability of technical and skilled workers, and the availability of professional workers. So three of the top five were availability of workforce, and the final one was high-speed broadband. And none of those other four were in the top 10 8 years ago.
So 8 years ago, people weren't worried about sort of the demographic reality. Is it because businesses were not trying to expand as they are today?
Well, we were just coming out of a recession 8 years ago, and so we had, you know, jobs chasing chasing too few jobs. Now it's the opposite. We have jobs going wanting. And I think every business, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in retail, whether it's in hospitality, people are literally changing the way they do business because they can't get enough workers at the peak times in order to expand or keep up with their regular business.
Okay, well, we're talking with Yellow Light Breen and Amanda Rector about Maine's economy. If you have questions for them, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Amanda, I understand you have new numbers. We mentioned population earlier. What do we know about Maine's population, where we are today, where we seem to be headed?
Yeah, so this is always one of the most exciting moments for me all year is when the Census Bureau releases their new population estimates. So they released new estimates at the end of December for all of the states. And Maine's population, which has been growing slowly, but it's been growing the past couple of years, grew again, another 0.3% growth. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but there are actually 9 states that saw population declines. Maine was not one of those. And that group included states like New York. So states you might not necessarily assume were having population declines. So I was glad to see that we saw another year of continued growth in the population estimates. Certainly we're getting ready in another couple of years. We'll have the next decennial census, which will give us a really good sense. But the population growth that we saw came entirely from migration, people moving to Maine, either from other parts of the world or from other parts of the U.S. We have, for a few years now, seen a negative natural population change, so more deaths than births each year. Maine and West Virginia were the only two states that saw that, although Vermont only had 12 more births than deaths, so they're right on the brink of joining us. But we did see an increase in the migration into Maine, particularly from other parts of the U.S., and so we saw enough of that that it offset the, you know, more deaths than births, and managed to bring us some population increase. And I have updated population projections that we'll be posting, actually, hopefully later today on our website, that will go sort of into the future based on current and recent trends. And those are showing a couple more years of growth before sort of trailing off through sort of the next 10 years, continued growth, and then slowing. The real problem is that even though we're having some in-migration, we're going to need more and more and more in order to offset the aging of the baby boomers, primarily in terms of workforce availability.
So people are retiring, and even though people are moving to Maine, not enough people are moving to Maine, even to fill those jobs, never mind any jobs that might be caused by economic expansion, business expansion.
Right.
Is there a number you would like to see? What from an economist perspective, from your chair, is there sort of a sweet spot? And clearly there's too many as well.
Right. I mean, and there are certainly challenges that go along with too much too fast, along with not enough and too slowly. You know, I think that we need to be able to continue attracting enough workers so that we can continue to offset. You know, we'll probably see this more deaths than births continue for a few years now, given where the baby boomers are demographically and what a large group they are in our population as a whole. And so we need to bring in enough people that we can offset that and then continue to grow on top of it. So I don't have a particular number, but I think that if we can continue to increase that migration to the state, I think that will help in terms of setting Maine up for growth going forward, particularly as the baby boomers more and more enter into retirement.
And as you know, this summer there was a political firestorm when the Maine Department of Labor forecast we were only going to add about 100 jobs over the next decade. But by definition, if you haven't added any people, you can't add any jobs as a state. So making Maine work, two of our big areas of recommendation are growing the quantity of Maine's workforce and growing the quality of Maine's workforce. And by way of example, you know, we observe, look, you know, we spend a lot of money as a state to attract tourists to Maine. As a simple rule of thumb, shouldn't we be investing as much in attracting talent to Maine businesses as we spend on attracting tourists to our hospitality, you know, attractions? And then secondly, supporting a lot of Maine communities who are smaller than Portland and Lewiston, but we hope will be facing, frankly, some of the same opportunity to attract immigrants. How do we prepare and support those communities so that they don't have to learn it the hard way? This isn't an easy transition to welcome a lot of people to Maine who aren't necessarily multi-generational sort of Mainers and don't necessarily look or act or have cultural expectations the same as we do. We've got to work pretty hard to make sure we do it right so they feel welcome and can thrive here.
You know, you're talking about Maine's smaller communities. That is one of the bright lights in your report, isn't it? That we are, there's some good news coming from Maine's rural communities, especially its forest economy.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, after I think writing off parts of the forest products industry and especially sort of traditional, maybe magazine and newsprint, writing that off as a dying industry, we've had $500 million in investment in forest products in Maine over the past year. And so I think it's proving to people when you talk about package and labeling, when you talk about the future of more innovative building products like a so-called cross-laminated timber where you can build skyscrapers out of wood, or whether it's really innovative things like wood-derived biofuels, wood-derived clothing and textiles, wood-derived chemicals. There is a serious growth opportunity for Maine now to write the comeback story for what one of my colleagues calls the second golden age of Maine forestry.
Amanda, what other sectors are you seeing growth in? Where are you excited to be reading the statistics.
Yeah, and I think I want to, I think, talk a little bit more about what Yella was talking about, because I think we have seen in many different parts of Maine's economy sort of a rethinking of some of our traditional industries. I think boat building is another one where there's been a lot of new innovation around different ways of doing what we've done for a long time. Agriculture is one where, you know, certainly the brewery industry has taken off across the country, but in Maine in particular, and they're doing amazing things in terms of partnering with farmers so that we're not just making beer here, but we are growing the ingredients that then get processed here, and then we're shipping product all over the world from here. And I think the more that we can use that kind of a structure where we're doing some vertical integration across different industries and clustering together, that brings in the opportunity for not just Portland to grow, if we're talking geographically, but for more rural parts of the state to grow. And talking about, you know, farmers up in Aroostook County who previously maybe only grew potatoes now can diversify their crops, which of course is good for them, but is also good for the state in terms of being able to source more internally. The more that we can do our own internal sourcing of products and ingredients and then doing the manufacturing and processing here and then shipping from here, the more we can grow our GDP and hopefully employment and attract more people, and it'll all go nicely together and grow us as a state as a whole.
Okay. And so we've talked about beverages, craft beer specifically. We've talked about forest products. Are there any other areas you're especially excited to talk about right now?
Well, I think, you know, back to tying what happens in Maine to global trends, you know, this movement to consider land-based aquaculture at large scales in Maine, you know, and remove some of the sustainability and other challenges of wild catch in and or offshore pen-based aquaculture. You know, I know it's controversial in terms of making sure we get the science right, if we can prove to folks that, you know, the environmental impacts are the right magnitude for Maine to accept. That's an important conversation to have, but that's a global trend, right, in terms of demand for fish protein and how are we going to feed both the U.S. and the world, and frankly take advantage of the fact that we're importing most of this stuff into the U.S. now. And, you know, Maine can perhaps take a claim to be a national leader in a new version of an ancient Maine industry.
We're talking about the Maine economy. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Abortion legislation is expected to be a key issue at the state level this year.
States that are hostile to reproductive rights are going to be jockeying to be the state that sends a law to the Supreme Court.
With a conservative-leaning court, activists say the stakes are high for both sides. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Both Maine Public Radio and Television will carry the upcoming inauguration ceremony for Maine's 75th and first female governor-elect, Janet Mills. The event takes place at the Augusta Civic Center and gets underway at 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 2nd. The ceremony consists of a joint legislative session, the swearing-in ceremony, and the governor's inaugural address. Join Maine Public Radio, Television, and online services for special live coverage of the inauguration ceremony of Governor Janet Mills, Wednesday evening, January 2nd, starting
at 6.
Coming out
of the break, though, the new administration. I mean, we're having this conversation the day.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the economic outlook for Maine in 2019. Joining me, Amanda Rector, who's Maine State economist, and Yella Light Breen, who is president and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling
or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to calls and emails, though, I have to bring up we're having this conversation on an historic day in Maine tonight. Maine's first female governor, first woman governor, Janet Mills, will be sworn in. She's already doing events around the State House today. And there's already been a bill that she has said she will sign, submitted LD1, which would expand Medicaid. What is our sense of the economic implications of the expansion of Medicaid right off the bat? Amanda?
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Certainly, there are states that have rolled this out well ahead of us, and some that have been struggling, others that have done well. So, you know, I think that figuring out exactly how to make it work, how to pay for it, which, of course, has been one of the big discussion points over the past couple of years here, but trying to figure out how Maine is going to make it work for Maine is going to be really important. Certainly, I know that there are other states that have not been thoughtful enough about the process of how they've figured out how to do it there. And certainly that's not my sort of primary area of expertise, but I've seen some states that have struggled because of it. So I think as long as we are thoughtful about how we do it, I think that we can make it work in a way that it can be a positive for Maine's economy down the line.
And Yellow, in making Maine work, the survey, as you mentioned, of 1,000 business leaders, health care costs are the number one concern. How does Medicaid expansion affect their concerns, or does it?
Well, we had an advisory committee that was drawn from our board of directors, the State Chamber of Commerce board of directors, and they were, you know, unanimous in saying we should support Medicaid expansion now that the voters have spoken. And, you know, it's just a big example of cost shifting. We all pay for this, even if we're on private health insurance. You know, ultimately, those costs are passed along to the rest of us. So one of our first recommendation on healthcare is to end that kind of cost shifting and, you know, really realize the true cost of this healthcare for everyone. Then we acknowledge, though, look, you know, even if we cover folks who are currently using the emergency room or who are currently incurring these costs without coverage, we still have to drive down somehow the growth in cost in Maine. And that means a lot of public health initiatives. And I think there's an effort out there called Public Health Reimagined to, you know, try to reinvest in how do we prevent a lot of the preventable cost of disease and death in Maine in order to drive down the gross cost of health care, regardless of who's paying for it.
And we've been talking about this for a long time. I remember Governor Angus King saying if we could just get Mainers 10% healthier, it would save the money so much, the state so much money.
You know, I think this actually has a lot in common with public education in the state. And I was reflecting on this. Maine has been at various times actually a national leader in public education. And we've also been a national leader at times in public health. And I think the problem isn't that we've done anything wrong in either of those two areas, but just like in your own company, if you're not constantly innovating and constantly pushing the envelope to get even better, then you actually begin to lag behind the country or lag behind where you need to go. So I think both of those areas need leadership and focus in the next 4 to 8 years, the same way we've had at various points in our history in Maine.
An email from Maria. Any idea of what the incoming administration means for rural internet access? We are two mid-career professionals who moved here to be near family and are lucky enough to work remotely for Fortune 500 companies, but find our work throttled by outrageously expensive and woefully unreliable internet and phone, cell and landline service. We don't want to leave Maine, but the status quo is not sustainable here on the Scudic Peninsula.
And we don't want you to leave Maine. I think that, you know, the expansion of broadband is something that certainly is, I think, pretty broadly accepted now as one way that we can really address a lot of the challenges that rural Maine does face. I you know, my understanding is that the nominated commissioner for Department of Economic and Community Development is going to have this as one of her top priorities, is figuring out how do we get the broadband situation sorted out here. And certainly not just for people who want to work remotely, although that certainly is an opportunity for growth, but also for things like telehealth and providing services to some of the rural population that has a hard time getting to doctors and education. And I think there are a lot of opportunities that if we can figure out how to make it work and how to make it affordable and reliable, then we can hopefully provide some additional support for rural Maine.
Yeah, in Making Maine Work, we call for a rather substantial investment in broadband infrastructure in the state, but also in terms of digital literacy and really kind of maximizing the usage of internet, because you're not going to pay $60 or $90 a month, even if you have access, unless you know you're going to get a lot of value from that product. I think the switch, as Amanda is saying, is really looking at broadband now as an economic development driver and not just kind of a personal consumer option or a personal consumer choice.
Sure, because how can a company compete if it doesn't have access to high-speed broadband?
Yeah, and I think the challenge for rural Maine is you don't really know, you never hear the dog that didn't bark. You don't know which entrepreneur or small company chose not to locate in rural Maine because they knew they couldn't get a reliable high-speed broadband access. So as an economic developer, I think if you can set the stage for those things that support not only large business, but entrepreneurs and remote workers across the state, that's going to be a huge part of the economy of the future of Maine.
We'll go to Don, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, good afternoon. A few questions for the state economist. I was interested in what her figures are for net in-migration as a percentage of the population and a percentage of the workforce, because while I'm in Augusta, I'm also in Kennebunkport more than half the week. And in southern Maine, there's a huge in-migration of retirees, which are both new people from away, but also what I hear from other attorneys, clients who are coming back to Maine as their health declines, they want to be closer to family. So if they get counted, it's strange that they may have also been kind of going back out of Maine in the first place. So, again, I was interested in the percentage change in the population, the percentage change in the workforce in the recent past, and what her forecast is.
Sure. So is Don kind of the question you're asking of all the people moving back into Maine, how many of are considered of working age?
Right.
So it's a little bit challenging to get to that level of precision with the data that we have. We have to rely on a different survey to get data about the age of the people moving into the state. But if you look at the data that comes from that, for 2017, if you look at the breakdown by age, the two age cohorts that had the largest percent in migration to Maine were 25 to 29-year-olds and 30 to 34-year-olds, which, of course, was very encouraging from my perspective because those are two key cohorts, not just as young workers, but also hopefully as young families. So certainly if we can attract not just more young workers to the state, but also people who are going to come and have some more kids, maybe we can start offsetting more of the more births, more deaths than births situation that we're in now. Overall, Maine's total net migration in 2018, the annual rate was 3.8 per 1,000 population, which is sort of a random number. But I can tell you that that ranked 19th for growth in the U.S. So in terms of how Maine's migration is faring sort of as a whole, if you look at the U.S., we're actually doing pretty well.
All right, Don, thanks for your question. An email from Kim. Thanks for the great program today. I'm wondering if any of the panelists have any ideas or comments regarding the lack of marketing and distribution for farmers and their goods in rural sections of our state. These same regions also lack reliable public transportation. There has been much talk in our household about how to solve both problems at the same time. Any thoughts, Yellow? I have a feeling you've been thinking about this.
I think it goes to one of the perennial problems that Maine has. You know, one of the great things about Maine is that we're a state of small business. One of the disadvantages of being a state of small business is that we don't have kind of that economy of scale when it comes to accessing big markets, accessing big wholesalers. trading internationally, or even in recruiting for workers. You know, as a sea of small business, we don't have HR departments, let alone marketing departments, let alone international trade specialists. So I think that's why it actually puts a huge premium on us working together. Sometimes that's through a state agency like the Department of Ag or the Maine International Trade Center. Sometimes it's through businesses coming together as they did in liveandworkinmaine.com, which is a common portal to recruit workers from outside Maine's borders. So I think small businesses, whether they're in ag or any other sector, you know, we're going to have to gang up. I think we've had some great programs, but I think increasingly this focus on marketing Maine's wares outside of our own borders, we've been doing it for a long time, but we've got to double down on that, because the data, I think, tells us that if you trade goods and services outside our borders, you know, the wages and salaries in those kinds of businesses are markedly higher than just trading amongst ourselves locally.
All right. Go ahead, Amanda.
I was just going to add, you know, one of the things that I think we're starting to get some traction here with the International Marine Terminal out of Portland, that's opened up a lot of trade opportunities globally through the North Atlantic region that we didn't have access to before. So I think if we can continue to expand on that, I know that the Port Authority is determined to open this cold storage facility on their own. It's been sort of in the talks for a few years, and I'm optimistic that if they can get that opened for Maine agriculture in particular, that will open up a lot of opportunities.
And I should just tag on, there's a group called Focus Maine that is working on local food and agriculture and local aquaculture, because we don't think this trend of local, traceable, authentically produced food is a passing fad. We think it's a long-term trend that's here to stay. And so they are doing precisely some of what the emailer suggests in terms of how do you provide kind of some of these almost tech-oriented incubators and top gun type of programs for ag and aquaculture and not just for, quote, high-tech companies.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Bethel. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll try and make it quick. I retired here, but I'm looking still again for work just to keep busy. And I find that jobs, even though I'm professionally educated, all of that, I find that they take one look at the age and they say, no, there's not even a question of, well, you know, sure, are you capable? And I would like that addressed, that age gap thing where you're looking for workers and you're seeing there's a lot of jobs out there going wanting, and yet people are not hiring retiree-age people who want to work.
You know, John, this is an issue I know AARP is working on, trying to get employers across the nation, not just here in Maine, to look differently at the aging workforce, because aging workers have a lot of skills.
Yeah, and I think that certainly is something that businesses are going to have to come to terms with if they haven't already, that in the workforce situation that we're in now, what we need to do is first and foremost make sure that everyone we have here who is interested in working and able to work is engaged in a job, because that can fill a lot of the vacancies that we do have. And I think that, you know, in the past where maybe the thought was, oh, you know, we want to hire somebody that we're going to get 10 years out of, that's not going to hold water anymore, I don't think. Businesses are going to have to be looking at, okay, maybe it's figuring out how to cobble together a couple part-times. Maybe it's figuring out, okay, here's somebody that we'll have for a couple years while we figure out what the next step down the line is. And certainly being able to engage the workers that we do have and potential workers that we do have is sort of the short-term solution to some of this employment gap that we may have, where we've got jobs that need more people, where we work at attracting more workers down the line.
Yeah, you know, I think this is just one area where our culture and our expectations are still struggling to catch up with the economic and demographic realities. You know, one other example of that is our work on education, where the vast majority of new credentials and degrees and skills are going to be from people who are already in the workforce, most of whom are already working at least part-time while trying to go back to school. Yet most of our systems, were designed for more traditional students age 18 to 25. So this issue of redesigning kind of our workplace cultural expectations, because I think the one thing that gives me optimism that that sort of silver tsunami of the demographics won't actually hurt us as much as it might look on paper is because a lot of people won't fully retire, and they will, that 70 is the new 60. But our culture has to catch up with that. Almost, I think, celebrating, telling a lot of success stories about where that's working in workplaces across Maine, so that it almost becomes, goes from, isn't that extraordinary, to ho-hum, isn't that just part of the landscape of what work looks like today in Maine?
John, thank you so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Portland Food Co-op, a community-owned market featuring a wide selection of local and organic products, open to everyone 7 days a week.
On the next Fresh Air, punishment without crime, how our misdemeanor system traps the innocent and makes America more unequal. We'll talk with law professor and former assistant federal public defender Alexandra Natapoff. Her new book is about how the misdemeanor system disproportionately punishes the poor and working class. Join us.
Fresh Air coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public has two paid summer internships available this summer for college or technical school students interested in careers in the news, journalism, digital news, and/or technical broadcasting fields. Candidates should preferably be attending an institution based in Maine or have an existing connection to the state of Maine. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers, or contact the Human Resources Department at 207-330-4506. Our application deadline is January 20th.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, reading the economic tea leaves for 2019. My guest, Yellow Light Breen, president and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation, and Amanda Rector, Maine State economist. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. An email from Sarah. I would like the state to make sure that no matter the area we move forward in, forestry, aquaculture, agriculture, whatever, that we put the environment and our wildlife ahead of all ideas.
It's a great observation. And by the way, you know, we mentioned measures of growth at the top of the hour. Our tracking report on Maine's economy includes a couple of key environmental indicators, and those are gold stars this year. They have been virtually every year in terms of Maine's air quality and water quality are just two that we use as rough proxies for the environment. It doesn't mean you can take your eye off that. We don't want that situation to change. Increasingly, that's going to be a huge economic asset for Maine. I guess I would say, rather than putting it first or second, I don't view it as an either or. You know, we need sustainable forestry practices in order to have a long-term outlook in that industry. All these other growth opportunities that Amanda and I have talked about have to be done in environmentally sustainable and sensitive ways, or they won't make sense for the Maine brand. They won't be accepted by Maine people. And frankly, we just won't be able to sustain them. You need communities to support these growth opportunities, or they can't happen.
We'll go to Leah, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Leah. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling and wondering what the panel thinks about the budding cannabis legalization potential and the current medical marijuana and hemp production that's going on in the state, and how, you know, if they feel that that's a good economic opportunity. I wonder also if perhaps some of that demographics that they spoke of earlier, the younger population coming into the state, isn't coming here in to come work in that industry.
Interesting question, Leah. Thank you. Amanda, has your office studied what the cannabis and what the hemp industry might mean for Maine's economy?
So we haven't done any sort of a formal study, at least not yet. But certainly, you know, as we sort of figure out what all of the rules and regulations are going to be around it, I know that we've looked at what some of the other states that have been down this road already have seen. Certainly, it does seem that there is some economic boost from it. I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether that same economic boost happens here now that it has been rolled out in a number of other states. It's always sort of hard to gauge.
And our neighbor Canada.
Right. You know, is it how much of it is, you know, the novelty of it in the first states that sort of rolled it out are seeing that sort of tourism aspect where people were, you know, trying to figure out exactly what was happening there versus anywhere else. I don't know that we'll necessarily see a huge amount of growth from it, but it certainly has the potential to impact certainly the industries and parts of the industries that are related to it, agriculture being one of those. We just don't have any numbers yet. Anything that we would have would be a very rough guesstimate. But it's something that certainly we'll be keeping an eye on as it does ramp up.
All right, Leah, thanks for your question. We'll go off to Bar Harbor and Ann Lynn. Hi, Ann Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. What I wanted to ask about was affordable workforce housing and particularly rental housing. I know the island is unusual but not unique. Here we have a real problem with, like, hotels that are open in the summer buying up rental apartments, kicking out year-round tenants, and then using them just for their summer workers. And in terms of attracting and keeping young people and young families here, housing is a big issue, and rental particularly.
Sure. Yellow, I had the opportunity earlier this year to attend the conference that is a town Maine town managers and county managers. I think this was their number one concern, affordable housing for the workforce.
Yeah, I had a chance to talk to the 50 state directors of the programs that support housing development and community development across the U.S. who are meeting in Portland. And I told them this is the most important meeting going on in the country. Because, you know, I think more and more community development and including housing development is economic development. And the reason for that goes back to this fierce global competition for talent. If we don't have good housing stock, we can't attract and keep that talent. And if we don't have livable communities in general, we can't attract and keep that talent. Bar Harbor may be an extreme, as the caller said. Another extreme might be the fact that you've got, you know, two huge Portland companies, WEX and Vets First Choice, putting their headquarters right in the old port in Portland. That can't be cheaper, I assure you, and it's going to be a hassle for parking. But they're doing it because that sense of being part of a real community, the authenticity and the walkability and the livability of being part of a real, authentic place is what's going to help them retain and attract talent from all over the world. And it's worth, you know, that move from a generic suburban office park to pull it off. So livable communities are going to have to be one of Maine's selling points and is one of Maine's selling points.
Ann Lynn, thanks for your call. An email from Greg. It seems as though the growth in population is not evenly distributed around the state. I wonder if your guests can comment about changes in population at the county level, because from my perspective, it looks like growth, particularly in working age people, is concentrated in the Portland area. The average age of my county, Lincoln, is well over 50. Will that continue to increase? Amanda, you're nodding.
Yeah, so certainly there is some regional difference to the population growth, although I will note that in 2017, 12 of the 16 counties did see population growth. So it's not maybe limited just to Portland, but certainly, and Lincoln County, of course, had been the oldest county in the state for a number of years. Piscataquis County, within the past couple of years, took over as the oldest. But I can understand the perspective for that particular county, and it is very much sort of the more economically vibrant parts of the state, southern and up through sort of the 95 corridor and then coastal regions, that have seen more of the population growth. My hope is that, you know, as the Portland area and then sort of Bangor and maybe Lewiston, Auburn start to see some expanded growth, the people who have moved here to those areas are going to maybe look a little bit further afield, and so that growth will help expand to other parts of the state as well. Certainly, we need to do as much as we can to focus on those rural parts of the state that are struggling and figure out what our best solutions are for those areas. We talked earlier on the program about broadband being one of those potential solutions.
We'll go to Richard, who's calling from Perry. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is about railroads. Why don't we have a commuter line going all the way up to Bangor? Right now it stops at New Brunswick. Why? And then also adding a freight line to Eastport, which is one of the best natural seaports in Maine and also on the East Coast. Why haven't we done that with expanded our railroad? That's it.
Richard, when you're talking about commuter rail, are you talking about the Downeaster going as far up the coast as Brunswick?
That's correct. Then it should go all the way up to Bangor or Ellsworth, either way, you know, and then continue on to Eastport.
I'm sure there are others who agree with you. Yellow, have you heard any noise about expanding the Downeaster further?
Well, we actually work a lot with the folks at the Downeaster, and you know, I think they've been all the time are asked to look at the feasibility of expanding service to, say, Lewiston area, expanding service up to, say, the Rockland area, or even expanding service, you know, as far up as eastern Maine. But I think it all comes down to a feasibility game, especially for the non-seasonal part of the traffic. You know, what can it really support? You know, with some modest or affordable level of subsidy. So I think they're obviously very open to constantly working with the community to assess that. But at some point, someone has to pay, right? We either have to be willing to subsidize it or there's got to be enough traffic to support it. The rail to Eastport is another very interesting question, and I think a thorny one. It's certainly a constraint on that port realizing its true potential. But you've got a lot of problems in terms of, you know, potentially expanding rail service across either a national wildlife refuge there or the causeway across the Passamaquoddy Reservation there. So it's not easy not only to wave sort of the financial wand of what makes sense, but also to figure out kind of the environmental and community impact aspects of doing something like that, even if you think you want to do it.
Richard, thanks for your call. An email from Rob. What data is available to understand the potential threat of job losses from business closings due to owner retirement? Business owners whose children don't want to take over and can't sell their business. We're the oldest state in the nation, and that holds true for our business owners as well. I've seen surveys showing 80% of Maine business owners say they want to retire in the near future, but that fewer than 20% have a viable exit plan.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's one of the issues that probably doesn't get talked about as much when we talk about the aging population. But certainly it's a very real issue, is that in a state of so many small businesses and entrepreneurs, those owners are aging too. And so wanting to sell your business to have it carry on to the next generation, you know, figuring out where is there a buyer. And it may not be sort of your kids, it may not be the neighbor down the block, maybe it's somebody from out of state that you haven't met yet. Figuring out how to connect those people, I think, is a challenge that, you know, just like the live and work in Maine folks are trying to connect workers with businesses, that a similar kind of partnership for maybe the ownership side of things could be a helpful tool down the line.
Yeah, I think every financial advisor or professional advisor that I know is more and more trying to work with clients around this challenge. You know, sometimes you say you want to retire, but it's hard to let go. So it's a very complicated dynamic. It's going to take a lot of creativity. There's groups in Maine working on cooperatives as one scenario. The Cooperative Development Institute, I think, is going to be part of this equation in really interesting ways. But I think, you know, one of the hardest things, and this maybe is my 12 years of banking talking, when you replace the sweat equity of the owner that built a business with debt equity of someone buying it, you know, it can really change the financial dynamics of a small business. So it can go from an amazing business to a really struggling business overnight if you don't have an awesome transition. And I think that is a big challenge for us as a state.
Amanda, it's a new year, which means another raise in the state's minimum wage up to $11 an hour. What impact do you see, if any?
Yeah, so I think this is the first year when we are starting to reach a threshold where it's going to really be sort of more of a visible impact. Up until this point, even with the increase going up to $10, there actually weren't that many businesses that were still paying less than that, simply because they were already having so much trouble finding workers that they had to pay more than that. So wages had been sort of naturally increasing on their own. We may be reaching the point now where that floor is getting a little bit ahead of where the natural increases had been, although the numbers I've seen looking at sort of the wage levels and how many workers are at each wage level are a couple of years old, so I'm a little bit out of date on those. But certainly there are some parts of the state where those increases are certainly going to be more visible than others. The Portland area, certainly wages have been going up quite rapidly, and that still probably isn't going to really be visible down there. But some of the more rural parts of the state, the challenge is going to be, can the businesses afford to keep up with these wage increases? Will they be enough to attract workers to those regions? You know, if you know that you can make $11 an hour working in a more rural part of the area where cost of living is less, is that enough to entice you there, or are businesses going to be faced with sort of a tough situation where they can't find workers and they have to pay a certain level that isn't enough to attract more workers? So we'll see. It remains to be seen how much of an impact it'll have this year.
I'll wrap up with a big question, an email from Tom in Yellow. I'm going to give it to you for less than a minute. What do you recommend Governor Mills do differently than Governor LePage that would be most helpful to Maine's economy?
I think you've got to have a long-term economic strategy that has wide buy-in, because it's going to be very important to persist in whatever we do across economic cycles and across election cycles. And so coming in and maybe forging a shared vision that transcends party and that brings the private sector, state government, and our communities together, something we can stay the course on for a decade or more.
Well, as always, it's such a treat to have both of you on the program. The voice you just heard, Yellow Light Breen, the president and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation. Also here with me, Amanda Rector, the Maine State Economist. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8 or after our coverage of Governor Mills' inauguration. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the political outlook for the year ahead. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.